In just 5 short years, Netflix has upended the industry, pouring unprecedented amounts of money into original content, spending $8 billion this year and airing 487 shows. Networks have been scrambling to regain their footing, trying to carve out a space as a viable option to Netflix. So writes Jason Lynch in a recent article in Adweek. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. What difference has it made as viewers have moved from networks to Netflix, as cable and digital streaming services have challenged traditional TV watching models? How does this industry work? And what are consumers to make of the growing array of options? Do TV channels matter anymore? Joining me is Derek Johnson, professor of media and cultural studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of Media Franchising, Creative License and Collaboration in the Culture Industries, and also the editor of the recent anthology called From Networks to Netflix, A Guide to Changing Channels. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks, Emily.
So in your final chapter of this anthology, you open with a description of a 15-year-old boy who is trying to watch different Star Trek shows and going up on the roof and changing the position of the satellite to try to get them from various neighboring community broadcast areas and getting frustrated by the static. Now, I assume that that 15-year-old boy is you?
That was me, yes. Although I didn't go up on the roof. We had one of those antennas where you know, it was like a large antenna next to the house, not on top of the house, and there was a device you could turn to rotate the antenna. So we did have that. So it was a little safer than going up on the roof sounds. But yeah, lots of fiddling with the dial in order to pick up distant channel signals.
I'm always interested in why people go into a certain area of research where they spend so much of their waking life on a certain topic. And with your interest in TV, in media in general, in the industry behind it, and in how TV channels work in a digital age and so on, where do you trace back your interest? Is it to the love of the shows themselves or something else?
I mean, in a way, yeah. I mean, I think that's a good story, and I use that story in that chapter for a reason. Yeah, I think it's having a love of the shows, but also wanting to know where they come from, right? And in that particular moment, trying to tune in a distant UPN channel. That was UPN at the time, the network. You know, that was definitely an instance where it wasn't just that I wanted the content. I had to be very much involved with where is this content coming from, right? There was this over-the-air signal that I needed to capture and this complex network, national network system that was affiliating with different local broadcasters in order to deliver it to people. And I needed to kind of, as a consumer, get myself into that that space. So yeah, it's you know, being a fan of television programs is something that led me to TV studies, but it's also, you know, just the way in which I think that interest in TV content led me to think, where's it coming from, and what are those sets of institutions and technologies that bring it to us.
I realize, looking at the many different chapters in your book, how out of the loop I am, because first of all, I still don't have cable, so I've got the basic broadcast ones. But then also, it just seems there's such a proliferation of all these kinds of platforms and devices and mergers of companies and Hulu this and, you know, Apple TV. And I don't know. It just seems to be impossible to keep up with all the different ways you could watch a show now. So if you go back to that same 15-year-old boy trying to watch Star Trek, like, what today is out there that wasn't then?
Well, I mean, I think it's the question of proliferation is definitely a question of the proliferation of channels, right? That's one of the reasons I think channels, despite being sort of an old-fashioned word that's been with us since TV was introduced as a consumer technology, and it's not something, I don't think Netflix openly calls itself a channel or Hulu calls itself a channel necessarily. They might want to distinguish themselves from these old forms of media industry. I still think the channel is this really productive way for thinking about these issues because it captures that sense of proliferation and multiplying choice, right? So in the broadcast era, when television was introduced, a channel sort of referred to this over-the-air frequency, right, that one would literally tune into on a dial like we were describing just a moment ago. It was a number on the dial, channel 1, channel 2, channel 3, and so on, right? And those channels each represented a local broadcaster, you know, each of which was licensed by the FCC to operate on that channel frequency, right? And in any one market, you could only, without getting interference, there was only room for so many channels in that space, right? So you probably had 3 to 5 channels to choose from, right? That probably sounds familiar to the TV that you remember growing up with.
Yeah, and so let's say you have ABC, NBC, and CBS. Mm-hmm. There you are.
Right.
And then later adding in public television. But let's just start with those big three. Was it the technology that changed that made suddenly all these other things happen? Or, you know, 'cause you've got these major TV companies coming out of also radio.
Mm-hmm.
And then what changed?
Well, I mean, it was definitely a technological change, also fed by regulatory changes where the FCC was really interested in trying to support a greater number of channels than the broadcast spectrum would allow. But so you had the introduction of cable technology, again, with the FCC being interested in
and happening
promoting
how?
That.
I mean, I guess I don't understand what cable actually does.
Yeah, okay. So,
the,
you know,
the way
cable works, I mean, it was originally introduced because there were some areas where broadcast signals just couldn't reach. Like, imagine a community that's hidden behind a mountain, right, where there's a mountain between that community and the nearest stations that are sending those over-the-air signals. The mountain blocks the signals. So you had entrepreneurs come in and set up cable systems in that local community where they set up an antenna on the other side of the mountain and laid the cable to capture that signal and bring it to the local community, right? So initially that was a technology just for relaying existing channels to hard-to-reach areas. But then, you know, people got thinking and said, hey, we can use the channel capacity of the cable system, which has a capacity for more channels than the broadcast spectrum. We can use that to provide additional content. And then later on, the FCC stepped in and said, well, if you want to run a cable system, you have to provide additional content, because traditional broadcasters were kind of getting worried that, like, you know, are we going to get sort of pushed out of the business by this new cable model? So it was kind of like, if you want to run a cable system, you've got to do more than just relay broadcast signals. So you've got to offer additional content. So you've got these cable operators that are then signing into contracts with content providers who are going to step in and say, hey, we can fill this channel space on your system. You know, I'm HBO or I'm MTV, I'm Nickelodeon. We'll come up with a service that we can use to fill that space, right? And in exchange, you'll cut us in on that subscription money that you're getting from your consumers.
And we're talking about big business here.
Yeah.
And I never really understand how that all is happening behind the scenes, because sometimes if you do watch a show, it might be a CBS show originally, but it's airing on a different network, and then it's got some, I don't know, other company that's credited as well.
There's all kinds of different ways that we could explore the money there. I think what you're referring to there is like what was called syndication, right? Where after a show airs on CBS, as you say, right? It might then, the rerun package might be sold to local broadcasters, which may be affiliated with CBS, may not be affiliated with CBS, by the company that actually owns the rights to the series, right? So when a studio makes a television series, they usually enter into a license agreement with the network, right? The CBS or the ABC or the NBC to carry that series. But then after CBS is done with it, the rights revert back to the studios, and then they're free to sell that in other ways. First, it was to local broadcasters, then later to cable, now to Netflix. It's that same kind of business model of having a package of episodes that a studio like CBS or a studio like 20th Century Fox can go and, you know, say, okay, we've got this package of episodes. Let's sell it to Netflix so they can put it in their library. So,
that's
why
it gets even more confusing.
Yeah.
Is
so, I mean,
it's overlap.
I mean, I spend a whole semester in my class talking just about like following this money through all these various ancillary markets, from syndication to DVD to now Netflix, and with cable in between there as well.
I forget when it was that it became possible to tape a show, so that you no longer had the same viewing habits where you had to watch a show live.
Right. So VCR was introduced in the mid-70s, right? But in terms of becoming like a, I think it took a while for market penetration there. So, but you know, by the 80s, people had, not all people, right? I mean, VCR is still consumer technology, not everyone could afford, but a good number of people had the ability to kind of, record television, to time shift it, as it was called.
Right. And to start forwarding through ads, which
yes.
must have
yeah.
frustrated a lot of advertisers, because that's another thing that, if we're talking about the industry and the money that follows all this, there's, you know, we have now some shows that don't have ads, some that do, technology that skips them. Mm-hmm. How big a component in the sort of TV industry would you say the advertising is?
I mean, advertising historically was, you know, the breadbasket for the industry, right? So, you know, one of the things that maybe hasn't been clear as we've been talking about it so far, like, you know, when we talk about local channels, over-the-air channels, we've been describing them as ABC, NBC, CBS. Well, they're actually local broadcasters, right, that affiliate with those national networks. And so the one of the, you know, they're local broadcasters. Now large conglomerates actually own, like, you know, lots of different stations in many different local markets throughout the country. But those local broadcasters are affiliating with the national networks in order to get programming, right? NBC, ABC, CBS, they're providing the local broadcaster with programming. And in exchange, what the local broadcaster is doing is cutting the national networks in on those local advertising markets, right? And so it's for the hope of getting a piece of that advertising economy in New York, Chicago, LA, Dallas, Madison, Milwaukee, you know, in all these, there's like 210 local markets throughout the country. It's wanting to get a piece of all those markets by creating this national affiliate network and hoping to get the advertising money that's in all those markets that, you know, someone like NBC or CBS would even like be in this business. So yeah, so historically advertising was where it was at. And then what cable does, it introduces not just new technologies for delivering television, but new business models for, you know, making money from television.
Do you mean now, like the subscription type
exactly.
thing?
Yeah, exactly. You're right. So it's not just, I mean, most cable channels, HBO, your premium channels, HBO, Showtime, like those are, you know, you pay $15 a month for HBO and that's how HBO funds itself. Right.
Whereas, and then you don't need any advertising.
Right. But most cable channels, you know, your CNNs, your ESPNs, they're all, you know, they're kind of a hybrid model where they get a piece of that subscription money that Charter or whoever your cable company is. I guess they're Spectrum now. Whoever your cable company is, you know, each of those, you know, hundreds of cable channels get a tiny piece of that bill that you pay every month. And it varies based on how powerful those channels are. Right, so ESPN gets like $6 or $7 out of every cable bill, whereas most cable channels just get pennies. They don't even get a full dollar. They just get some fraction of a dollar as part of those big bundles and packages.
And is it still mostly Nielsen ratings that drive the that seems to be the one standard.
They still matter, but that's been something that's changed over time. On the one hand, Nielsen ratings have been adjusted, like with DVRs. You mentioned time shifting mm-hmm. earlier with the VCR. I mean, the idea of time shifting is important in a lot of different ways. But in this context, time shift is important because people might record something to watch on their DVR, but that means they're not watching it in the hour that it was on as scheduled by the television network, which is traditionally how network ratings are measured, right? Did you watch it when it was programmed? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things Nielsen's done in the last couple of decades to try to account for that is to develop what are called Live Plus ratings, where, you know, it doesn't, they're still measuring in the old way, did you watch it when it was scheduled? But then they have like an additional number that says, but if we also counted the people who watched it on their DVR within the same 24 hours or within the next 3 days or within the next week, then that adjusts the number. So some shows have been, you know, saved from cancellation, for example, because despite having low ratings, their Live Plus ratings are actually high enough that the network has said, okay, we're gonna let it ride here. Although, you know, a Live Plus rating isn't as good for advertisers as a live rating, because like imagine it's Thursday night and the advertiser is a major motion picture, right? Mm-hmm. You want people to see it on Thursday night because you want them to go on Friday or Saturday right. to be a part of that weekend box office, right? Or you're a major furniture store and you've got a weekend sale going on.
Or
right?
You put breakfast in their idea.
Exactly.
Like
yeah.
That.
Like yeah. Advertisements are often time sensitive. There's something that we want the consumer to do right now. And so if they wait a week to watch it, or like me, sometimes I wait months to watch things that are on my DVR.
What if you never watch the ads? I mean,
yeah.
we generally tend to, let's say, record the news mm-hmm. and then not watch them, just forward right through those ads.
Yeah.
That must be...
That's another huge problem
yeah.
for the traditional television business. And that's why we see a lot of product placement, right? Mm-hmm. Where you can't skip If it's part of the content, then you don't want to skip through it. And so you see product placement as a way to try to, you know, make up some of those revenues that might be lost when advertisers, you know, say to networks who are trying to sell them advertising time, well, maybe we don't want to pay this anymore because we just think people are going to skip through it. You know, you look for other ways to build partnerships with the advertiser and say, well, what if we make you the content, right? Or make you part of the content.
Then nobody can skip it.
Exactly.
Well, we've been talking about commercial stations mostly, but what about the advent of public television in the toward about 1970 or so? What difference did that make that you have a station on television as well as on radio like us, but on television where it's not supposed to have advertising?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that certainly that was, say, 1967, I think it was, is when the Public Television Act was passed to create the public television and radio system. And so, yeah, like that, I mean, that just creates an alternative model for funding television, right? Television doesn't have to be funded through a commercial economy. It doesn't have to be what television doesn't have to be just what there is a market for. Right, we can have television that is, you know, after other goals, other imperatives besides just making money. The trick with that, as you well know, right, is that with the way that the public television system was funded, that funding wasn't insulated. It wasn't protected from political interests and political squabbling, right? So, you know, as we're familiar with in the news, like we hear every couple of years, well, we're back up for renewal and Congress has a decision to make. What are they going to do? Big Bird gets threatened by Mitt Romney, things like that. You know, and so the question of the sustainability of that model is always in question, right? Because that funding isn't guaranteed. Right, that funding can always be threatened to be taken away if lawmakers who are making these appropriations don't like what they're seeing on public television.
Also, it seems there's kind of a way to get around the money from commercials by having corporate sponsors. Mm-hmm. So on both public radio and public television, you have a list of corporate sponsors that reading those names often seems like an ad to me.
Yeah, like Viking River Cruises on public television. I'm not sure what makes that different from a traditional advertisement spot. I think typically they've called this enhanced underwriting rather than advertising. But yeah, it becomes difficult to distinguish the two, yes.
I want to talk later in the hour about things like the marketing of products, including Elmo and other spinoffs from Sesame Street, and just how the whole business goes beyond just a show on a particular network. We're going to talk more about the process of going from networks to Netflix when we continue in a moment with University of Yale. Theme from Stranger Things from Netflix. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Derek Johnson. We are talking about from networks to Netflix and the whole process of moving from original broadcasting on channels to a whole array of options. So we did talk a bit about going from just the major three broadcasters, adding in public television, and also adding in cable. But with the internet, it seems things have just exploded in terms of how and where and why and what we're watching. Can you say something about Netflix in particular? And,
sure.
And also just what the relationship between all this is?
Yeah, and sometimes when I talk about Netflix, I might be talking about like Netflix and all the other streaming services that there are, like
and by
Amazon Prime, Amazon Prime and Hulu and HBO Now, you know, all the way down to like smaller services like CBS All Access, right? So these are streaming services that you subscribe to. So it's kind of like the cable business model, but it's different from cable in that they're not necessarily bundled anymore, right? Your cable bill is for, you know, $60, $100 for, you know, hundreds of channels, most of which you don't want. Whereas in this streaming economy, it's a subscription model, but you're subscribing to individual services that are a smaller bite. Right, out of your checkbook.
And the streaming simply means that it's coming through a web, through the computer.
Exactly.
And not through some satellite or...
Right, yeah. So, the delivery mechanism is different. It's being delivered by your internet service and not by a satellite, not by a cable wire, and not by broadcast antenna.
You say in your book at one point something about the water imagery involved here, mm-hmm. where we've got, you know, channels and flow and streaming mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. currents and all that stuff. But sometimes it's just hard to visualize how this all is accessible to us. But with Netflix, let's start there. And with a show like Stranger Things, what would you want people to know about how that comes to us and what that means?
Sure. So, you know, Netflix, we might describe it in terms of a shift from what we were talking about previously with broadcast and cable television being linear. Right, in that you have at those networks and at those channels, you've got programmers who are making decisions about what shows to buy, when to air them. Right, they're scheduling them in particular ways. They're deciding that this show is going to air right after this show in the Wednesday night lineup, for example. And then they're also making decisions about like branding the channel themselves. Right, they're trying to come up with identities because each channel might be trying to target a very specific audience, right? Like Lifetime might be targeting more women and BET is targeting more African-American viewers, right? So mm-hmm. each channel is trying to carve out a specific brand identity for itself. So Netflix, we can contrast to that in that it's nonlinear, right? Like it's not scheduled. There's not a...
It's just there.
It's just
and you
there.
Get it and you
yeah.
control the
yeah.
timing.
It's a menu of options, right? Here's an entire library of programming, more so than any one viewer could ever watch all of, right? And it's up to you as the viewer to decide what to watch when. And so, you know, that's very different, but it's also not completely new either. Like you brought up time shifting with the VCR. Earlier, right? We've had time shifting with DVR. We've had DVDs that have allowed people to, you know, program television on their own.
And where does TiVo fit in there?
TiVo is kind of like a digital video recording service. I would sort of think about that. And they're a proprietary company, but technologically, I'd consider it very much like DVR. So we have had these time shifting technologies that allow people to program television at their own schedule, right? And to decide what to watch when. Right. But Netflix really takes that and runs with it. Right. Where you just have this menu of options and it's up to you to decide what you're going to pick at any one time. So
and how big a business is it? Like how huge is Netflix in terms of the amount of money they bring in and who's controlling it?
I don't have exact figures for how much revenue Netflix is bringing in at the moment.
Is it sort of ballpark compared to the major three networks or just sort of...
It's really hard to measure the success of Netflix comparatively to other television companies, right? Your traditional broadcasters. Like, first of all, like you mentioned at the very beginning, the amount of money that Netflix is pouring into the development of original programming. It's billions of dollars, I believe. And that's something because like they're working in the world of like Silicon Valley venture startup capital where they can go year after year after year without turning a profit if they want to, as long as that like venture capital model is still working, they can take those risks and run those deficits. Whereas these established legacy companies, they can't say, well, we're going to spend a couple $1 billion on programming this year. And if it doesn't work out, well, it's a long-term investment. Like they've got a more immediate, like we've got to keep our stockholders like happy every quarter kind of mentality, right?
So Netflix is both distributing shows and making their own?
Yes. They're distributing shows, they're delivering shows to us if we're subscribing to them. And yeah, they're also making their own shows. In this environment where we have so many choices of television services, it's important to have exclusive content. I think that's one of the things I'm most interested about in terms of what I write about you know, television services like CBS All Access that I wrote about in this book, is that you've got to, it's not enough just to have a channel. It's not a question of if you build it, they will come. You need to have very specific content that is going to attract people to your channel when, you know, they have choices. I have the choice to subscribe to Netflix or to subscribe to Amazon Prime. They have a lot of the same stuff, right, in terms of the library content, the old reruns of this series and that series. You could find a lot of the same stuff on both services, but each of them have particular original series, exclusive series that you can only get if you subscribe to Netflix, right? So if you want to watch Stranger Things, you've got to subscribe to Netflix.
I assume the same was kind of true with, say, PBS having Sesame Street or Downton Abbey or Masterpiece or whatever it was, that there were certain things on the networks that were also kind of became almost like an identity for that.
I would say almost exclusively, right? Like network shows, like until the aftermarket, right? When the package was sold into rerun syndication, right? When a show was in its first airing, it was only available on that channel. Right. When The Daily Show is on Comedy Central, it's only available on Comedy Central. But with then selling all these series, the rights to them into all these internet services and internet packages, that changes the game there, where suddenly if you want to watch a particular show in first run, there are options depending on the show. There are ways to, you know, to see it in multiple different places.
And so let's say you want to measure whether the viewership for Stranger Things on Netflix, which can only be watched through that, since people are controlling when they watch it and so on, how would a traditional measurement like Nielsen ratings figure it out how popular a show like that was?
Well, that's one of the ways in which which Netflix is kind of crafty, is that they refuse to release numbers about their viewership numbers. Right. So this is actually something that frustrates their some of their partners. Right. The companies that are helping them to make the original programming that they're offering is, you know, they don't like to work in Nielsen metrics, and they don't measure themselves in that way. Although they might, but they just don't make it public. So there's no way to compare how is a Netflix series doing in terms of millions of viewers compared to a broadcast series. Like, those metrics just aren't publicly available, as much as Netflix competitors would very much like to have those numbers available. Though the other way to measure these things, and this ties into what we were talking about earlier with Nielsen ratings and how they've changed, is Nielsen ratings aren't the only game in town anymore in terms of measuring the success of television. There's now things like Twitter ratings, where what's being measured is the impressions that a show is making, right? Like, how out there in the public conversation is this show?
So looking at a show and then how much sort of chatter about it
exactly.
is out there?
So it's less about who watched this show, and it's more about who's talking about this show, which, you know, if you are a believer in Twitter ratings, like, who's talking about a show, right? What kind of social network influence does a show have may be just as valuable as who's actually sitting down and watching it.
Now, if Netflix is not doing advertising, then why would it even matter how many millions of people are talking about a show?
Right. I mean, it doesn't matter in the same way to Netflix that it does for a traditional network, to be sure, right? Like, what matters to Netflix is that there is something on that service that gets its subscribers to re-up every month.
So having a kind of flagship show or a popular show or a talked about show is just a way of promoting the identity of Netflix itself.
And promoting the identity of Netflix, but also getting the subscriber or the potential subscriber getting awareness of that one series. All it takes is one, right? That one series that Netflix has that you think you can't live without. And then you pay your $10 a month, and as long as they have that and then something else to keep you so maybe it might take more than one series, but like, you know, another series when that series is, when you're done with that series, as long as there's something at all times that you really feel you need Netflix for, you know, you're going to keep paying your subscription, or so they hope. So if there's a social conversation about a particular series and you want to be a part of that, so say it's Stranger Things and you see everyone in your Twitter feed or your Facebook feed talking about Stranger Things and you want to be a part of that, well, you got to go watch it on Netflix in order to participate in that. Or, I mean, I think many people also go pirate this stuff instead, right? They acquire these through illegal means. But, that's okay. Something that the industry has little control over.
And so who would the main competitors to Netflix be?
Hulu, Amazon Prime Video, HBO Go, I'd say, are sort of the biggest names in streaming right now. Although we could also talk about YouTube as well, both in terms of its ad-supported model, which is, you know, YouTube's very, in a lot of ways, it's kind of that ad model of traditional broadcast television ported over to the internet. But YouTube also has its own subscription service, YouTube Red, which is trying to bring YouTube into that subscription game as well.
So you mean you can either watch YouTube with the ads or pay a little bit more and watch it without?
It's also a situation where they have exclusive content for YouTube Red. So if there's specific things you want to watch, you need to subscribe to that service.
One thing I'm noticing among students, the younger students who are maybe 18, 19, is how many of them seem to almost exclusively be watching shows on their phones, mm-hmm. on YouTube. Can you say something about devices and how we're watching? You know, how many people now are actually sitting at a computer? How many are still watching on a screen? How many of those screens are tied into computer systems? And how many are actually watching on phones or iPads now?
Yeah. In terms of how, again, I apologize, I didn't bring specific figures.
We wouldn't remember them anyway, but just sort of a kind of scope.
But yeah, I mean, this is definitely a significant viewer practice that has emerged in the last decade or so. It's sort of referred to in the industry as connected viewing or as second screen experiences, where, you know, this is definitely happening to the degree that television programmers are anticipating that their viewers are going to try to do this, and they are trying to come up with ways to harness that practice, right? Because as you can imagine, like distractedness in an advertising economy, like distractedness is kind of the thing that you're always trying to combat as a programmer, right? You want to keep your viewer tuned in to the program. You want them to pay attention during the commercials, and you want them when that show is over to keep watching the next thing, right?
Right.
You don't want them to change channels or look at other options.
Which is why I assume now at the end of a lot of shows, they start playing the next one.
Exactly.
Before you have a chance to get up.
And also the same reason why Netflix, they do that in traditional television, and that's the same thing Netflix does when they make the autoplay feature, where one episode just starts playing immediately into the next. They want you to binge watch, but that's a way of keeping you from being distracted by other choices, right? Keeping you from moving on to playing a video game on your console or checking out your phone or doing whatever else you might do. That idea of like fighting distraction is sort of an industry imperative, I think, from traditional television all the way up to Netflix. Now, so you put a phone in front of someone, and that's a distraction device, right? That is a clear and present threat to the television programmer who wants to keep that viewer in the flow of the television experience that's being offered. So the question is how to harness that. And there's really, I mean, there have been really interesting apps that have been developed, like the WWE, the wrestling, World Wrestling Entertainment. They came up with their own app that was about kind of curating all of the other internet experiences one might have around watching wrestling. So imagining the kinds of things that their viewers might be doing on the phone, like checking out Twitter, searching for backstories about wrestlers and stuff like that, and coming up with an app that kind of brings that all in this enclosed space to kind of offer that second screen experience to the consumer. And that's much better from their perspective. You know, even though it's the same Twitter feed that you could get if you were searching for the WWE hashtag on Twitter itself, but by bringing it in their app, they're able to filter out all the stuff on Twitter that isn't wrestling related, right? All the stuff that could pull them out of that wrestling experience and lead them to something else.
I don't want to sound Luddite exactly, or, you know, back in the days of, you know, horse and carriage or something, but don't you think there's something lost when you have so many options and portals and devices and platforms, and where the danger would be that you're almost encouraging a kind of fragmented you know, oh, I'm going to skip now after 2 minutes to this other thing and get little bits and pieces. Back, you know, if you go back to where you would only have the option of choosing one show, not even recording something else to watch later, but just watching one show as a family together at in a particular moment. It wouldn't there, in addition to just the sense of gain, it, wow, we can now have channels that are in Spanish. We can have all kinds of progressive shows, many different kinds of, you know, some targeted niche markets. You can have the weather. You can have sports, all these other things. And I can see the tremendous gain.
Mm-hmm.
But I also am wondering if you agree that there's something lost.
Yeah, I mean, sure, like family viewing, as you mentioned, is something that audiences aren't conceptualized as families anymore. They're considered as like, well, here's what the adults are going to watch. Here's what the kids are going to watch on Nickelodeon and Disney. And there's sort of this separation of the family viewing unit there. And to the extent that families are thought about today by the industry, like one of the things I've been doing in my research is thinking about like what I call transgenerational strategies, where it's not about thinking about the audience as a single family viewing unit, but it's thinking about how do we get the older viewers and play them off the younger viewers in a way. So it's that they're not unified, but they're still separate in this way. So I think there's definitely that division there in terms of the family viewing unit. And that's why the Nielsen ratings seem so so quaint in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. is that the way they're measuring, they were historically set up to measure television viewing is by units they called households using television. And so, like, thinking about the household who watches television altogether, you know, Nielsen has tried to adjust, you know, they, mm-hmm. they ask you to break it down by who's watching what when you participate in their studies. But yeah, there's definitely a passage of family viewing there. But I mean, you know, to what extent is family viewing inherently valuable? Like, I'm not sure. What seems more clear to me is, you know, sort of the social and political divisions that this fragmentation of audiences that comes with the explosion of all these different channel choices, right? I mean, what we see on Facebook today and social media in terms of, let's call it the taking advantage of political divisions in mm-hmm. our mediated experience of the world in which we live. I mean, this is something that, you know, is only an extension of what cable television begun with, you know, the creation of different news channels for people who have different political leanings, right? And sort of creating these echo chambers mm-hmm. In cable, where we only hear kind of the news that fits with our political opinions, as opposed to more of a consensus building, you know, like say what you will about all the things that were left out of the conversation. But in the broadcast era, the idea that like there were the national news services that, you know, tried to present the news to everyone, right? Like, mm-hmm. again, I'm not saying one is inherently better than
it's
the
very
other,
different.
But there's definitely a difference and definitely something lost there when we're creating segments out of society rather than a unified consensus.
Well, we probably have fewer moments where everyone in the country can recognize the same, mm-hmm. the way it used to be where, say Walter Cronkite or, mm-hmm. you know, somebody would be a major figure that everyone sort of knew, or Johnny Carson or mm-hmm. whoever it was in the past. There's so many more options out there that you can't necessarily assume everyone can talk about the same mm-hmm. show.
Right. Right. So that extends to entertainment as well, right? Less politically charged, but just like, you know, you can't, like, the idea of a water cooler conversation is a lot different now when you can't assume that everyone was watching the same program last night, because now everybody's watching, you know, whatever they want to watch.
Have there been studies done that you know of where it looks at the effect on mental health? Because I know I've seen some where it talks about sometimes the more time spent on Facebook or on certain things can actually make people feel more depressed. The more so-called connected they are, the more dissatisfied they can be in the moment, the lonelier in a certain way. I mean, that there is this sort of mental health challenge that comes from the way our viewing and scrolling habits have changed.
I mean, that makes sense to me. I'm not mm-hmm. a media effects researcher, so I don't think I have too much to say about that particular possibility. I don't think I have any more expertise in that than the average person. But I mean, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I look at my Facebook feed and I think sometimes it makes me feel disconnected from the world rather than connected. But maybe that's just my own personal psychology. That research is certainly out there.
When it starts to get kind of murky as to what's even coming where, because I've seen on Facebook a YouTube posting, which is actually a recording of a previous night's TV show, mm-hmm. And then conversation about that, it just seems to, you can start with one thing that then finds its way, and I'm sure people are tweeting about it, and it's just all over the place.
Right. Well, and I think the example you described there, like sort of trying to take this back to television and new strategies that are emerging in the digital age, is the idea that just a regular social media user can kind of become part of the distribution chain for television, right? We've been talking about mm-hmm. Netflix and these subscription services, but you and I, if we got on Facebook, we can be a part of that process of making people aware of television programs, of sending links and clips and like being part of that distribution system. And so that's why, going back to the idea of ratings and the way that they change, right, the idea of a Twitter rating that we're measuring social impressions and who's talking about things rather than who's watching. I mean, that's kind of the theory of the value behind that, because, mm-hmm. Users are increasingly in this position to shape the circulation and the spreadability of television.
Yeah, they're really almost functioning like distributors mm-hmm. in their own way. You have a quote that you include in the opening of your book on From Networks to Netflix from Tom Goodman from TechCrunch, who says, "The role of TV channels is irrelevant. To take the entirely anachronistic device of a TV channel and replicate it as an app is stupid in the extreme."
Yeah, so that's a quote I took issue with, because obviously I think the television channel is still a useful concept for us to be dealing with. I mentioned earlier, right, that in the historical sense of broadcast and cable channels, right, like those channels perform particular functions. They perform curatorial functions in that they were curating, content and presenting it to viewers in scheduled ways.
And when you say curate, because I always think of a museum, so the curator of TV shows is...
Well, what I mean there is like, well, just as a curator of a museum might have some sort of role in, and pardon me if I'm mischaracterizing museum curation, a subject I really know nothing about, but I assume they have some sort of power over, like, you know, not just the individual object and how it's presented, but the full...
exhibit.
Right, mm-hmm. We're creating an exhibit here. We're creating an entire presentation, not just individualized pieces of art, right? Same way that, the traditional cable channel has been creating a schedule, right? Not just picking single shows, but picking shows that are meant to, like, play off one another to build a night's television viewing. So they had that function. They had the branding function of, like, branding the channel itself. And then there's, of course, the development function of deciding what shows to air. I think Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, HBO Go, all these streaming services are still performing those functions very much so, right?
So they're functioning like channels in a certain sense.
Right. I mean, they're in a different context. They're nonlinear. They allow us to decide what to watch when. But even though we have the ability to choose from a vast menu of television options in that service, there's still ways in which that experience is being curated for us. So I mentioned the autoplay before, right, where when one Netflix show ends, they're just going to, like, go mm-hmm. right into the next episode because they want us to keep watching, so there's one thing. But, like, when you log into Netflix, you see a menu, and there's certain things that Netflix can kind of push at us, right? Their original series are usually pretty prominently featured, and that might encourage particular pathways, to use the museum metaphor, right, to mm-hmm. encourage particular pathways through what's on exhibit at Netflix, right? So they've got their interface that might push their original programming, but then they also have the recommendation system, which says, okay, if you like this, then you might also
that. Right, so they're keeping track of your viewing choices,
right,
too.
And But in doing so, they're also kind of encouraging particular pathways, right? If you liked Star Trek The Next Generation, well, then you might want to try Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Star Trek Voyager, right? So, like, there, it's not a linear pathway. We have choice there, but they're still very much like old television channels. They're structuring they're not controlling, but they're structuring that viewing experience for us. And so, yeah, I kind of think the channel model is still really, really relevant.
Some final thoughts on From Networks to Netflix when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Derek Johnson, who's the editor of the recent collection From Networks to Netflix, A Guide to Changing Channels. We are talking about how television viewing has changed so profoundly with the addition of cable and then of digital streaming. So your first chapter in this anthology is about the change in going from TV Guide to something called POP. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so TV Guide, what I was referring there to was the TV Guide channel, right? The TV Guide network that would actually be something you could tune into on your cable service, and it would provide on-screen listings and then later, little feature content to go along with that listing. And ultimately, they themselves went into original programming and ultimately said, hey, we're not a TV listing channel anymore. We're a channel in its own right, right? We're now POP. So the TV Guide brand kind of went away there. I thought that was an interesting idea, again, going to our discussions about content earlier and the importance of having content to fill a channel. The TV Guide channel, used to be a channel about other channels. Like, this is the channel that you went to briefly before going to tune into another channel. And slowly over the time, they were like, well, to get advertisers interested and to get more of that subscription revenue from the cable company, we need to be a destination in our own right. And so they slowly developed their own original programming and then ultimately became this completely different service because they realized that the real place they wanted to be in the business is, in sort of being a channel, not being a channel about channels. But I thought a lot about TV Guide in this book. And in some ways, I think the book, the idea for the book came from the idea, like the TV Guide magazine, right? Mm-hmm. Like the subtitle, A Guide to Changing Channels. I'm trying to evoke TV Guide there.
Which was one of the most widely read publications ever, right?
Right, and is also a publication that just like its, the cable version of it, the print publication went through a lot of changes as well, whereas the bulk of it used to be local TV listings. And then there was this moment where they're like, okay, let's add some cable listings in there. And then they basically gave up the listings altogether because they realized in a nonlinear environment where some people can't afford these new TV services and things, which I think is really important. Like when TV Guide, the channel, went away, it actually left a lot of cable subscribers without any guide to all the channels that they were subscribing to. The publication went through a lot of changes. And, one of the things that I was really interested in, or one of the things that got me very interested in doing this project in the first place is just I happened to inherit a bunch of TV guides from people who preceded me as a grad student when I was doing my graduate studies. I got from one of my colleagues who's finishing up in the program and moving away and didn't want to move the boxes with them, gave me tons of boxes. It was a whole decade's worth of TV guides, and that was a weekly publication, so it was a lot of TV guides. And he had received them from one of our professors previously, and I just held on to them, and they still take up a lot of space in my office. But I just think it's a really interesting way of thinking about television is not just about the content, but what are the channels that are bringing us that content. Yeah, I think that's what I'm trying to do with this book project was to, provide a sort of critical guide to television, not just telling us what's on television, right? What are the channel choices, mm-hmm. but helping us to understand the industry that produces all these choices.
I like some of the titles of chapters, including the final one, which was CBS All Access to Boldly Franchise Where No One Has Subscribed Before. And then you also have a chapter on A&E going from art to vice, which seemed kind of like a depressing transition. But a lot of the book seems to be about these transformations of existing networks or companies in the face of changing viewership. And I guess sometimes it's hard to tell which came first, the change in the public taste or the change in what was offered to them.
Well, I think they inform each other. Like one of the things that, at least in terms of the way I like to conceptualize the relationship between television, the industry that produces it, and its audiences, is to think about how they're all interrelated and not one is necessarily driving the other. So there's definitely ways in which the industry is trying to shape particular audience practices and get, I mean, that's the whole idea of television programming in the first place, right? Is trying to create a schedule that we're going to be able to attract audiences and then like sell them to advertisers, right? Sell that attention to advertisers. You know, so industry has this immense power to structure the television experience. But once you add audiences into there, they do things that the industry can't anticipate, right? Like they engage in practices like whether it's piracy or fandom or whatever it happens to be that the industry can't control. And so you have audiences doing these unpredictable, unruly things that makes television, one of the reasons I'm interested in television, in fact, is that it's this really sort of rich site for thinking about these struggles between like the top-down power of television industries and sort of the bottom-up participation of audiences within this cultural system.
And you have increasingly global mm-hmm. Ramifications with things being watched all over the world mm-hmm. and with merchandising where you can buy a Elmo at Walmart made in China and kind of wonder what the connection was to the original public broadcasting.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking earlier about the funding question for public broadcasting. And so in terms of children's television, one of the things that Sesame Street was quite famously engaged in was looking to commercial licensing, right? Like licensing the Elmo likeness to toy manufacturers who would, produce Elmo dolls and books and things like that as a way of helping to fund the public television operations that weren't being funded by public sources, right? But even that money was not enough to necessarily cover all the costs of producing something like Sesame Street, right? Imagine all those Elmo dolls. That's still not enough to pay the bills at Sesame Street, which is why, in 2015, you see Sesame Street decamp from PBS and say, okay, well, we're going to enter into this agreement with HBO because they're willing to write the checks that are going to be able to keep us in business in a way that the current funding situation for public television wasn't allowing.
I kind of imagine things are going to get more and more complicated.
Surely, yeah.
Because that seems to be the trend, wouldn't you say? If you imagine
that
15-year-old boy trying to get Star Trek, and you look at it now, and you imagine that same projected time, I'm guessing there's going to be even more options out there.
Yeah, I think there will definitely be more options. But I think by looking at sort of this long trajectory, not just of change, but also of continuity, right? Again, why I find the channel to be a useful thing to look at. I think we might see some hints at like where that future might go.
My guest has been Derek Johnson. Thanks for joining me, Derek. It was very interesting.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.